Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today, mostly sunny skies, high temperatures in the lower to mid-90s. And then for tonight, clear skies, dry conditions, overnight lows in the upper 60s to lower 70s. And for tomorrow, a lot like today, not quite as warm with highs in the lower 90s. Currently, partly cloudy, 93 degrees.
Three high-profile Democrats visited Arizona this week to campaign for Hillary Clinton. Her campaign has also put more money into the state. This comes the same week as the final presidential debate in Las Vegas, a new poll showing Arizona could vote for a Democrat for president for the first time in 20 years. We have two perspectives on the political week that was in Arizona and what the next couple of weeks leading up to Election Day may have in store, starting with Harry Enten. He's senior political writer and analyst at the website 538. And Harry, as far as the surrogates, where would we see any potential impact of those visits?
Well, I think, you know, you'd obviously look at the polls and see if the numbers have moved at all from when the visits started to when they ended. But I should point out there haven't been all that many public polls in the state of Arizona. There have been a few which tell us that the race is close, but they're not frequent enough so that we probably really be able to pick up on the effects that surrogates are having. But I think what the surrogates visiting the state indicate clearly is that the Clinton campaign thinks that they can win in Arizona. They really do believe this is not some one-off. This is not them just playing around. They really do believe they have a shot. Arizona is a legitimate swing state this year.
You mentioned that there haven't been a ton of public polls done in Arizona. From the ones that you have seen, what is telling to you? What kinds of trends are you seeing?
Well, I think what's really telling is that for the first time since 1996, there's a real shot that the Democratic candidate, in this case Hillary Clinton, can win the state of Arizona. We have seen a number of polls that have her up. There have been some polls that have it tied. But what we're really seeing is that the race is really close, and I think that there are two reasons why the race is really close. Number one, I think Hillary Clinton is going to get a very strong vote from the Latino population. Number two, we're seeing more Latinos register in the state of Arizona to vote. And number three, we're seeing unusual weakness among Mormons for Donald Trump. Usually Republicans sweep the Mormon vote. In this particular case, Donald Trump has had major problems with the Mormon population, both in Arizona and obviously to the north in Utah. So we are seeing that Trump is losing a little bit of ground among the Republican base, and we're also seeing stronger Democratic numbers for Hillary Clinton, and that's why the race is so close.
What kind of impact might her numbers and her potential success here have on down-ballot races?
Well, I think, you know, obviously we've seen a stronger relationship in the past few years between how people vote in the presidential race and how they vote in the House races, and how they, a little bit less to an extent, how they vote in Senate races. Obviously, John McCain, if you look at the polling right now, has a significant lead. He's almost certainly going to win re-election. However, in some of those tighter House races, which we are used to seeing in the state of Arizona, it wouldn't be shocking if perhaps there's some surprising upset that we're not really sure about at this point. With all the money that now Hillary Clinton is spending in Arizona, I'd keep an eye on those House races, see if there's any late movement in any one of them that we haven't seen yet at this point.
Based on the reasons you mentioned for why Hillary Clinton is doing better than expected in Arizona, do you expect that that would be sort of a one-off for this state, or do you think this state might continue to be a swing state going forward?
Well, you know, I will say a few things about that. Number one, I think one thing we've learned in this campaign is it's difficult enough to project what's going to happen in 6 months, let alone in 4 years. No one thought that Donald Trump was going to be the Republican nominee about a year ago, and here he is. But that being said, we do know that we have seen more competitive races in Arizona for the Democratic Party than we had previously seen. We haven't necessarily seen that result in a Democratic governor or Democratic senator, but it was only 4 years ago where Richard Carmona gave Jeff Flake a very strong run for his money, and we obviously have seen Democrats doing better in House races in the state of Arizona. So there's definitely been some movement under the radar of Arizona performing more strongly for Democrats. But this year, I think, is something that's really pushed it over the edge, and there's still some question as to whether or not we'll see it in 4 years. I guess what I'm saying is we're going to have to wait and see.
Harry Enten is senior political writer and analyst at the website 538. He talked about the impact Hillary Clinton's attention on Arizona could be having on down-ballot Democrats. Joining me to talk about that is Marcus Dellartino, a partner with First Strategic Communications and Public Affairs in Phoenix. And Marcus, let me start by asking if you think visits like the ones we saw this week really move the needle here.
What it does is it raises the momentum of your campaign, and that is helpful internally to your ground troops that are on the ground fighting the battle every day in and day out. So at the end of the day, it can move the needle just in sort of a different way than I think people traditionally think. It gets everybody's energy level up. Fundraising has a tendency to increase a little bit. People are more excited to walk door to door and knock on doors for candidates and make phone calls and put up yard signs. So from that standpoint, it does move the needle.
In this case, do you think that having Bernie Sanders and Chelsea Clinton and Michelle Obama here, plus the $2 million that the Clinton campaign is putting into advertising in the state, do you think that could help her win this state in November?
There's no doubt it could. And here's what they're trying to do. They're trying to obviously move the millennials, who they're concerned about staying at home this election cycle. And you'll notice in combination where they had their events and who they brought into town, they're clearly looking to get those younger votes moving, number one, and turn the state blue for Hillary. But also as a side effect, you know, they're looking at picking up, obviously, some congressional seats, maybe making some pickups in the state legislature. And so really, it's sort of the perfect storm for them of not only moving the needle for Hillary, but also moving the needle in other state offices.
Well, do you think the fact that she's doing better here than some had predicted, will that actually help congressional candidates, legislative candidates, maybe even the U.S. Senate candidate Ann Kirkpatrick?
You know, we are definitely picking up on our polls. You know, there are some traditional Republican districts where Clinton is outpolling Trump. There's no doubt about it. And that is having a down ticket effect on some Republican races. And if you look at what is traditionally some of the more moderate legislative districts, Hillary Clinton's doing better than Donald Trump. And I don't think that that's sort of shocking. But what is more shocking is it's having an effect on those Republican candidates in those districts.
When you look at the polling results that have shown Secretary Clinton in the lead here, even if she doesn't win Arizona, she will probably do better than many Democrats have done in the past. Would you attribute that to the fact that Arizona's demographics are shifting and maybe Arizona is turning into a swing state, or is this mostly on Donald Trump, do you think?
It's a culmination of events. It's certainly the perfect storm. One, there's absolutely no doubt that a large part of that is Donald Trump himself. But I think that there are other factors that have come into play, and that is certainly Arizona's population has changed. We've had a lot of people move here from New York and Chicago and California and every other state in the union, and that certainly had a change on our politics. And the Democrats have done a good job at keeping up on voter registration. Not that the Republicans haven't, but they've certainly kept it competitive. And independents are growing at a explosive rate, and I think that certainly this election cycle, some of the younger independents are going to be more attracted to Hillary Clinton than say, a Donald Trump.
What do you make of the fact that we're seeing Democrats outperforming previous elections as far as the returning of early ballots? Are there any lessons to be drawn from that?
It's a pretty significant development. You know, Republicans have pretty much owned early balloting in Arizona ever since its creation. Seeing Democratic ballots outperforming Republicans is concerning for Republicans, and I think is an early sign that there could be some significant surprises come Election Day.
Marcus Dellartino is a partner at First Strategic Communications and Public Affairs in Phoenix. Marcus, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Voters who live on the Navajo Nation have received attention in recent elections for the impact they've had on Arizona's 1st Congressional District. But there are concerted efforts during this cycle to get more members of all of Arizona's tribes registered to vote and casting their ballots before or on November 8th. With me to talk more about that push is Maria Dadgar, Executive Director of the Intertribal Association of Arizona. Maria, how strong is the effort now, and has there been a missed opportunity in the past?
The efforts are really going on across the country. They're national efforts, regional efforts, and local efforts. And our organization, Intertribal Association of Arizona, has been very, very active with 22 tribes. We have 22 sovereign nations here in the state of Arizona, and we've been very, very active.
Do tribal members in general know the impact that they can have on
a congressional election, a presidential election, and have they used that power enough, frankly?
They understand the electoral process, and they're very astute. Within our tribal nations, there are many elections that take place within each respective tribe. And so with knowing the outcomes and the results of their participation in the electoral process within their own tribal nations has branched over to where they understand very well the impact that they have and how important their participation is in these national and state elections that take place.
One concern that's been expressed when it comes to certain tribes is how far some tribal members have to go to vote. So there's almost a convenience factor there. Do you think that's still a problem?
Yes, that continues to be a barrier. Unfortunately, here in Arizona, it's such a vast state, and many of our tribal nations are in very, very remote locations. And so access to polling places continues to be a barrier. Some tribes have gone so far as to have a voter coordinator or voter education or voter outreach coordinator just within their own respective communities to constantly make sure they're outreaching, educating, and training their tribal members. In some cases, even translation into the respective tribal language is necessary. And so within the tribes and with certain organizations like mine, we are constantly educating and helping our voters with their participation in the voting process.
Well, considering Native Americans didn't even have the right to vote until after World War II,
Yes. It
seems remarkable that, first of all, that was the case. Why was that the case? And secondly, has that made tribal members value the vote that much more?
I really believe so, because it took such an effort. We were not citizens until 1924, and then we were not able to vote until after a number of lawsuits were posed. And so it wasn't until 1948 that we actually were able to win the right to vote. And because of all of that effort, that information has been shared amongst all of the tribes, not only here in Arizona, but when we meet nationally, it's part of our national dialogue. And so that has really heightened the importance of voting, and everyone is really, you know, on board with making sure that their community members, their neighbors, everyone is there to participate in the process.
Now, so much of what we hear about was Congressional District 1 in Arizona, because that involves the Navajo Nation, which is huge. But you also mentioned there are 22 sovereign nations total. So what are we missing if we focus just so much on one tribe as opposed to the impact that members of other tribes can have around the state?
Well, here in Phoenix, in the Phoenix metropolitan area, we have an urban population that exceeds 100,000. And so that's huge, and we have huge impact. That population carries a lot of weight. They have access, and they participate. And then, of course, they're sharing with family members back in the more remote areas as well. So it has huge impact.
Maria Dadgar is executive director of the Intertribal Association of Arizona. If it feels like you can't escape Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton wherever you turn right now, you're not alone. The American Psychological Association released a new survey this week that shows more than half of Americans say the election is stressing them out.
52% of Americans surveyed say the campaign is a very or somewhat significant source of stress in their lives, and it seems to be true across demographics. The show's Lauren Gilger joins us with more on this. And Lauren, is being stressed out about this election a bipartisan issue?
It is. Both Republicans and Democrats reported this in high numbers. And the survey showed that it's true for people who are young and old, and it goes across racial and ethnic groups as well. Interestingly, millennials, those between the ages of 19 and 37, were more likely to say they're stressed out by the campaign, and older people over 71 were more likely to say it as well. And the survey found that Hispanics were more likely to say that the election is a source of stress for them.
Well, so what does that mean for our political system?
Well, it could be having a big effect on our political parties. I talked to Samara Klar about this. She's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Arizona, and she says the fact that people are reporting this kind of negative reaction to the election isn't surprising, and actually isn't completely new either. For the last several years, she's been studying the rise of independent voters in America, and she says more and more voters are hesitant to identify with either party because of all of this negativity.
There's so much negativity in politics. There's so much aggression, so much combativeness. And most Americans don't see themselves like that. That's not how they want to identify. So what we're seeing is actually a plurality of Americans who now just identify as independent. Even though they truly hold partisan preferences, they may have voted for the same party their whole life, and they'll probably always vote for that party. They don't want to identify with that party because they don't see themselves as a negative person.
So that's the identity piece of it. Are the numbers reflecting that?
Absolutely. We're seeing a steady increase in the percentage of Americans who will not publicly identify with either party. Right now, it's at about 40% of all Americans say they're independent. We know that 40% of Americans are not voting for a third party, and these are people who are just declining or refusing to vote. They're voting for the same party they've always voted for. They just don't want to publicly identify with that party.
Yeah, and you think it's kind of in reaction to the negativity surrounding politics. Do you think that politics is getting more negative?
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence to show, first, that media coverage of politics has certainly become more negative. Media disproportionately cover politics in a negative light. We've also seen that politicians themselves are using increasingly negative rhetoric. My co-author, Yana Krupnikov, and I oversaw a content analysis of presidential debates over the last 20 years. We had our coders code for the percentage of phrases that conveyed insurmountable conflict. And what we see is over the past 20 years, that percentage has grown dramatically. So we're seeing this massive incline in the percentage of phrases in a debate that convey the message that our parties are never going to get along. And I should add that content analysis was done before the 2016 election.
Before these debates.
Yes, exactly.
So that's really interesting in terms of this two-party system that we've always had in this country. How do you think that what you found in this rise of independent voters or people identifying as independents will affect the parties?
Well, one of the biggest problems for both parties is that independents may vote for them every year, which is a good thing, but they're not going to engage in all sorts of activities that are going to publicly betray their partisanship. So for the sake of argument, let's say I'm a Democrat and I don't want people to know it. I'm not going to put up a yard sign on my lawn. I'm not going to wear a sticker. I'm not going to go campaign for Hillary. I'm going to go vote for her, and then I'm not going to say a word about it. So Republicans and Democrats who are trying to conceal their partisanship are not going to engage in the kinds of grassroots activities that the parties really rely on when it comes to campaigning.
So where do you see this going in the future?
Well, you know, it's kind of tricky to try to figure out how we can solve this problem. I think one of the biggest problems is that independents don't necessarily want compromise. So, you know, if you ask independents, what do you wish the president would do? They're more likely than our partisans to tell you, I want the president to compromise. But we followed that up with an experiment in which we manipulated in a little political vignette whether or not the respondent's own representative compromised or whether the other party compromised. And to put it simply, people get very unhappy when their own representative is the one that compromises, independents and partisans alike. In American politics, compromise means the other party compromises. So, you know, I don't know if compromising is really the answer here, because it doesn't seem like voters reward representatives who engage in that behavior.
So do you see our election process becoming any less negative in the future?
You know, I hope so, because I actually do think that if these debates and discussions between the two parties were conducted in a more civil manner, that might bring independents back into the partisan fold. My impression from researching this for the past few years is that Americans are very comfortable with debate and they're comfortable with disagreement, but they just want this to be done in a civil, mature fashion. Nobody, Republicans, Democrats, nobody is really happy with this sort of combative tone that has overtaken American politics.
That was the show's Lauren Gilger speaking with University of Arizona professor Samara Klar about her work studying the rise of independent voters in the U.S.
The Arizona pro sports team with the most hardware is leaving. It's league, not the Valley. The Arizona Rattlers have won 4 Arena Bowls and are one of the longest tenured teams in the Arena Football League, but they've announced they're leaving the AFL for the Indoor Football League. Richard Obert is a sports reporter for the Arizona Republic and covers the Rattlers. And Richard, what led to the team's decision to switch leagues?
Well, it all had its done to the Arena Football League. If you look at the history of the Arena Football League since the reboot, they went through bankruptcy in 2009, so they didn't have a season. They came back in 2010. And the single-entity business model that they went with just really wasn't working, you know. Teams were having to bail each other out every year. I know they had 12 teams 2 years ago, and now they were down to 8 teams last year. And then that got dwindled down to five teams if you count the Rattlers. The belief that from the owner, Ron Schertz, that the league, you know, was too iffy. It was too much of a chance. He didn't want to take that chance that there would not be a league at season next year. And he wanted to make sure the season ticket holders and the diehard Rattlers fans that they still had a season, they still had a product to go and cheer for.
What are some of the differences between the Arena Football League and the Indoor Football League, both in terms of the on-field product and sort of how the league is structured?
Yeah, the Indoor Football League, they're looking at 10 teams this year. It starts in February. It's basically the same time frame. It's February through July. The Indoor Football League, though, is totally different because the AFL is patented, so they cannot use, you know, their rules. Basically, they can't use the nets. That's trademark.
Their nets behind
so
the goalposts.
No, yeah,
in the
there's
Arena
no
Football
there's
League.
Nets in the AFL, and there's no nets in the IFL, and there's a thing called a rogue rule where you get a point if you down the return man in the end zone. And if they get the ball through the uprights, they're awarded a point. So it's a lot of different kind of weird, quirky rules to this league that it's something that the Rattlers are going to have to get used to or try to educate themselves with.
Will they be starting over with an entirely new roster of players?
Yeah, I think so. The pay scale for the Indoor Football League is only $250 a game, where the AFL was like $800 to $1,000 a game. And so, you know, I mean, they're getting free housing. They're getting free expenses, transportation, and there's like 6 months, you know, basically free living, but it's just pocket change, you know, every week for these games. And unless there's some changes with their finances, if they can entice these guys to play, I have no idea if they'll be able to keep any of these core players that they have, because now they've all become free agents and they can join any of these four existing Arena Football League teams.
Given that the Rattlers have been associated with the Arena Football League for as long as they have and have been as successful in that league as they have, is there a risk, or does the owner see a potential risk to the brand of the team moving to a different league with different players?
Yeah, well, the one thing that they want to make sure they have is that the Rattler logo stays with them, that they don't have to give it up to the AFL, because I've heard that the AFL owns the rights. They'll negotiate, see what they can do to make sure that they keep that brand. They don't want to have to rebrand, but it could be with a whole different group of players. They're going to have to start over. I know Kevin Guy, the general manager and head coach, he's very, very good at recruiting and reinventing this and making sure he's got the best product he can. Because it's going to be tough, because there's a team out there in the Midwest called Sioux City. It's a Sioux City Storm that's won 6 Indoor Football League championships in a row. So he'll do whatever it takes to be able to knock those guys off.
Richard Obert is a sports reporter for the Arizona Republic covering the Arizona Rattlers. We're talking about their departure from the Arena Football League and move to the Indoor Football League. Richard, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Phoenix is investing almost $600 million in renovations to Terminal 3 at Sky Harbor, and the first phase of that project is almost complete. There was a media tour today. The show's Annika Klein poked her head behind the construction wall.
It's a bright, open space with floor-to-ceiling windows right next to the much darker original building from 1979, which is still in use during the hammering. Mayor Greg Stanton walks over to a cluster of chairs.
Power USB, which is a very important thing for the traveling public.
Every chair will have outlets. There are also touchscreen ticket kiosks. Jim Bennett is the city's director of aviation services.
Every kiosk, every ticket counter, every gate is common use.
That means you can check in anywhere, no matter which airline you're flying. Bennett says renovating Terminal 3 gives smaller airlines here a chance to expand. Most of the flights out of Sky Harbor depart from Terminal 4.
But over 20% of our market is Delta, United, Frontier, Spirit, Hawaiian, Alaska. They need additional facilities as their business continues to grow. So this helps us diversify our base and also serve all of our customers.
Passengers will be rolling through the new ticketing and security area by the end of the year, but they'll have to keep waiting for new retail and dining options. The terminal project is expected to be completed in 2020, with 25 gates. Terminal 2 airlines will move to Terminal 3, and Terminal 2 will be demolished. Stanton says at some point, that land could be the site of another new terminal.
We want our existing partners to offer flights to new locations, including international destinations, and we are always courting new airlines to offer flights in and out of Sky Harbor. We can only do that if we have the capacity to offer them.
The City Council votes next week on a plan to extend the SkyTrain out to the rental car area. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
Legendary artist Frida Kahlo was especially well known for her self-portraits. A quote attributed to Kahlo reads, "I paint myself because I am so often alone and because I am the subject I know best." Her huge impact on art, particularly in the Southwest, continues to this day. And earlier this month, the Tucson Botanical Gardens became only the second locale in the nation to host the exhibition Frida Kahlo, Art, Garden, Life. With me to give us more details about Kahlo's connection to nature and the exhibition is Michelle Conklin, Executive Director of the Tucson Botanical Gardens. And Michelle, what is that clear link between Kahlo's art and nature?
This exhibit focuses, and there has been no other exhibit at all that has ever focused on this topic, how plants and nature inspired her work. You know, that's the focus of this exhibit, and it's perfect. I mean, for Tucson, many of the flowers that you see in her paintings and the nature that you see, the migration of the butterflies, you see those in her artwork. So it's just the perfect blending of, you know, kind of like a perfect storm, but not.
Are there a few sort of paths you can take us down, what people will see if they have a chance to go down and see it?
Sure. Well, the first thing I think a visitor will be inspired by is the color blue. You know, Frida's home was named Casa Azul, the blue house. And starting at the front gate, we have recreated that blue. We have recreated the Mexican fence post that was in Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera's yard right on El Vernon. As you walk into the garden through the gift shop, the first thing you will come to is the entrance to Frida's home, which is a 15-foot-high, 20-foot-wide entrance to Casa Azul. As you walk through that, you will walk into what was our wildflower garden, and the front piece of that garden is the pyramid that Diego Rivera built for Frida Kahlo to display her cactus and her plants and her Aztec statuary. Of course, this is not the original pyramid, but it has been recreated, and it was recreated and designed by a very famous scenic designer in New York City named Scott Pask, who is also a University of Arizona graduate and a Yuma, born and raised in Yuma, Arizona.
Frida Kahlo's life was not an easy one, and she was someone who thought about things in a really deep fashion. And I'm someone, to simplify this again dramatically, when I think about nature, I think about something that is in many ways a calming, soothing influence on us. Is there anything to indicate that it had that effect on her and her art as well?
Well, I think when you look at her art, you will see that she expressed a lot of the pain in her paintings using plants and animals, the thorn that is around her neck, you see the drips of blood. But there is no doubt when you look at her photographs and you look at pictures of her in her yard and watch the videos and even look at some of the paintings of the fruit and some of the flowers, you'll see that her love of nature is really, I believe, what calmed her down and what really gave her some peace throughout her life. But there's no doubt that she used her paintings to express her pain. You know, we really wanted to talk about how the plants inspired her art, and there is not a painting that she completed without a plant or an animal or something in that painting to reflect nature.
Being in this business as you are, is there a need, is there a desire, is there a great connection to be made between the natural plants that Tucson uniquely has, that Phoenix has as well, and blend them with other sorts of projects? Is that something that feels like a natural fit? In some ways, is it a necessity to get more people to come?
Well, it is a trend throughout the country, throughout botanical gardens, to combine exhibitions with botanical gardens. You know, really, Chihuly really set that off. And then Nature's Connect with Legos, we had that last year. That was the first time. So last year's exhibition was our first foray into a major exhibition. What it does, I mean, it's twofold. Number one, it helps people who might not otherwise ever step foot into a botanical garden make the connection between botanical gardens and art and science and culture and geography. It is the perfect outdoor classroom to teach all of those lessons. Another factor is gardens, public gardens must become sustainable and attract new audiences and give people reasons to come more than once a year, to come over and over again, because gardens do change seasonally, and every time you come, there is something new and different to see. And as a botanical garden that really is very small, 5.5 acres in an urban area, we rely on that admission ticket, and that donation and that membership to sustain us and care for our plant collection, which is really quite significant for a small public garden.
Michelle Conklin is executive director of the Tucson Botanical Gardens. We've been talking about the new exhibition, Frida Kahlo, Art, Garden, Life.
The TV sitcom Parks and Recreation had a lot of funny people on it, but one in particular tended to stand out. Maybe it was his mustache, or maybe it was his way of looking at the world.
Metaphors? I hate metaphors. That's why my favorite book is Moby Dick. No frou-frou symbolism, just a good simple tale about a man who hates an animal.
Recently, I made a chair. When I was finished, I thought it was a good chair. I submitted it to the Indiana Fine Woodworking Association, who felt it merited consideration for an award.
Winner is Ron Swanson for chair.
Nick Offerman has, in fact, built lots of things out of wood. In addition to acting, he's a woodworker and owns a wood shop in L.A. He's also an author. His new book is called Good Clean Fun, Misadventures in Sawdust at Offerman Woodshop. He'll be in the Valley on Tuesday night at Mesa Art Center, and he joins me. So, Nick, there are so many things you could potentially do at your appearances. What will people who go see?
I learned early when touring a book that it's not the greatest idea to make it like a comedy show per se, because it has much more of a book fair feeling to it. And so the show is still a lot of fun, but it's mainly reading from the book and then doing a Q&A, which traditionally is the funnest part of the evening. For some reason, people that come to see me ask the best questions.
So like what kinds of things do people ask you?
You know, it's funny because my writing, while humorous, usually has elements of like manners and sort of old-fashioned work ethic and lifestyle. I love especially college-age audiences because there's lots of great questions about life choices that will lead to happiness versus life choices that will lead to misery.
I'm curious if your sort of tinkering, especially at a young age, and you know your parents were very clear about telling you that it's okay if you don't get it right the first time, and you talk in the book about how you know in some cases you didn't get it right the second, third, or however ever many times beyond that. I'm wondering if that helped you, especially early on in your acting career. We hear so often about actors going to LA and not having a lot of luck getting roles. Did it help you knowing sort of how to fail?
I suppose it must have. I mean, it wasn't something cognizant that I was aware of at the time, but I've always had a very easygoing disposition in general. And so things never went great for a lot of my life, but they usually went okay. And on the occasion that I would fall flat on my face, I think my upbringing really trained me to shrug and say, well, you're going to fall on your face once in a while. If you're falling on your face twice a week, then maybe you should think about another vocation.
What do you see as the similarities and differences between the kind of precision that you demand of yourself in your wood shop and the kind of precision that you require and your coworkers require of you on a set?
Well, it's all making stuff, you know. Whether we're making a half-hour comedy or we're making a dining table, it just comes down to work ethic, you know? It's understanding the responsibility that you bring, especially if you're part of a team. Your audience or your furniture clients are depending upon you to bring all of your experience and talent and knowledge to bear upon this particular project. Making a TV show is really fun, but it's really hard work. It's the product of incredible precision, just like in the shop. You know, if we take our time and use our experience and sharpen our chisels as perfectly as possible, then the end result is going to garner a lot more appreciation.
Have you ever had the opportunity to build a piece of furniture for a show that you've been on or a movie that you've been in?
Well, by and large, the schedule of filming and the schedule of woodworking do not align very well. On Parks and Rec, for example, many times the producers would come to me and say, we have a story coming up in 3 weeks where Ron builds a crib with Rob Lowe. how do you want the woodworking to go, and do you want to make anything? And I would say, well, between now and 3 weeks from now, I'm shooting two more other episodes. So unless I stay up all night, I can't really make a crib. And so I would often get to steer how things were made and what processes we would shoot. And also Ron's shop was my shop. But there were some things, specifically Ron had one canoe throughout the series and then a second canoe in the finale. Those are both canoes that I made.
How much of that character, of Ron Swanson's character and his interest in woodworking and some of his other interests, in fact, were in fact based on you and things that you were interested in? Because there was an episode where you went, I think, to a woodworking convention or something, and the character was just beside himself with glee.
It's true of a lot of great television comedy characters. They take elements of our personalities and they use them as the inspiration. And so people from the perspective of your couch watching the show on your screen, it's easy to conflate me with, like, oh, Nick is a woodworker, so is Ron, so Nick must be Ron. And what I always insist people understand is that they use parts of me as the inspiration, but these people are the most brilliant comedy writers in the country. And so they take my woodworking and they wring comedy out of it in a way that I could never come up with. And same with my love of steak and scotch and, you know, brunettes that look like my wife.
Is there a piece of furniture or something else wood-related that you is sort of on your bucket list of something you'd really like to design and build that you haven't yet had the chance to do?
You know, both in the wood shop and in my entertainment career, I don't really have a great answer to that, because people also ask me, you know, what's the great role that you want to play? What's your Hamlet or whatever? And my honest answer to that is whatever the next one is. So everything I get to make as an actor or a writer or a woodworker is the best.
Actor, humorist, and author Nick Offerman will be in Phoenix at the Mesa Arts Center on October 25th. His new book is called Good Clean Fun. Nick Offerman, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. We'll see you soon.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.